It's Friday, June 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Greece's prime minister says there will be a solution to the country's debt crisis. A new warning is issued about the escalating cost of violence worldwide.
Fueled mainly by the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, but not only those conflicts. Central African Republic have got a lot of the refugees.
And one of Bob Dylan's biggest hits celebrates the half-century mark. It's all ahead. Greece's prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, says there will be a solution to the country's debt crisis that will allow it to stay in the eurozone. Well, for more, I'm joined by VOA Europe correspondent Al Pessin in London. So, Al, what is the current status of the negotiations surrounding Greece's debt crisis?
Well, as we heard in the newscast, the finance ministers of the countries that use the euro did not reach an agreement yesterday, so their bosses, the top leaders of all those countries, will try on Monday. But there are a couple of schools of thought about this situation. One is that the leaders eventually will reach an agreement, if not on Monday, before the next payment is due on June 30th. But the other school of thought is that they won't reach an agreement and that potentially Greece will miss this June 30th payment to the International Monetary Fund. And then we'll see what happens after that. Some people think that would be a disaster, but other economists say it wouldn't really be that big a deal to miss a payment. The question is, how many payments will they miss, and will there ever be some sort of agreement on what the end point of this crisis will be?
Yeah, well, what possible further steps could Greece take to obtaining a lasting deal? Because yesterday, on Thursday, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde says Greece cannot delay paying its debt.
Well, the thing is, there have already been a lot of delays in Greece paying its debt, and both sides are talking tough, so I try not to get too wrapped up in any one statement from any one side. But in terms of the first part of your question, what they need to do in the long term, the creditors are demanding what they call further structural reforms, more austerity, more belt tightening. And in Greece, it probably comes down to some cuts in the pensions of retired people, and Greece certainly doesn't want to do that. But economists point out that these additional austerity measures are relatively small compared to everything that Greece has done over the last 5 or 6 years. And that argument cuts both ways. On the other hand, politically difficult in Greece, but economically maybe not so difficult. And for the creditors, significant in terms of proving Greece's credibility, but not so significant also in economic terms. So that kind of leads to an optimistic assessment that in the end, reaching an agreement may not be all that difficult, but that's not a universal view.
What is known about Mr. Tsipras's current negotiations in Russia with Russian President Vladimir Putin?
Well, not a lot. And, you know, the Syriza party is a leftist party, and there have been contacts between Russia and the new Greek government before, and Russia was reported to be lobbying the Greeks to block some European Union votes on Ukraine on a non-economic issue. So there is potential for some exchange of benefits there, maybe some loans in exchange for political positions, but nobody knows if that's what they're talking about. Nobody knows if the Greek prime minister would go that far to try to block European Union moves on other issues. And also, of course, Russia's economy is not doing too well. They're under sanctions, and they probably don't have so much financial help they could give. So it may be a routine visit. It may be related to this, but certainly the timing makes it very interesting.
Yes, certainly. Thanks very much. That's Al Pessin in London. Well, for more on the Greek debt crisis, I'm joined by VOA's Ira Melman.
Joining us now to talk about this is Mauro Gillen. He's the director of the Lauder Institute at the Wharton School of Business in Philadelphia. How serious would it be if Greece did indeed leave the Union?
Well, for Greece itself, it would be very traumatic because foreign investors, as you can imagine, will take their money out. Greek nationals will also try to take their money out. As a result of that, there would be very little money available for investment and for creating jobs. All of those contracts, you know, literally millions of contracts, anywhere from, you know, a car loan to a lease on a house denominated in euros would need to be renegotiated, right? And then be denominated in whatever new currency they adopt, the drachma, right, which is the currency that they used to have. So just imagine the litigation that would occur in the wake of all of those negotiations. It would be bad for Europe because essentially this would demonstrate that the European currency union was not forever. In 1999, it was launched as if it were irrevocable, as if it were going to last forever. And if one country gets out, that means that more countries could get out. And so the danger is also for Europe, but I think it's also for the global economy as a whole. Remember, Europe is about 25% of the global economy. And from a financial point of view, Europe plays an even more important role in the world. So it will be yet another source of instability and uncertainty for everyone, including the United States. So I think it's in everybody's interest to try to fix the Greek problem. But the issue is, are the Europeans willing to go all the way and come up with a permanent solution, or do they want to just keep on kicking the can down the road? I am a little bit pessimistic about the prospects for a permanent solution because I just see that the positions of the two sides are just too far apart. It was a crazy idea to think that countries such as Greece and Finland could be in the same monetary union, or that countries like Spain or Portugal and Germany could be in the same monetary scheme. It's just crazy because some countries in Europe are very thrifty, very frugal. They're very much focused on productivity. And other countries, you know, for whatever set of reasons, they are not, right? And so it's very difficult to have one currency, one interest rate, one monetary policy for both kinds of countries.
Professor, I thank you so much for giving us the time you have. And hopefully this helps out informing people around the world what's going on.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mauro Gillen of the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, unfortunately, what's trending today is the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. As everyone knows by now, Dylan Roof, a 21-year-old young man, went into this historically black church in Charleston, shot and killed 9 people. The hashtag Charleston shooting was used throughout the day yesterday and still being used today to share information, grieve for the victims. Yesterday, it was used 869,000 times. So that's just an idea of the scope of this tragedy and how it's playing out on social media.
Yeah, an immense impact.
Absolutely. And now we have kind of these other stories that are coming out from this tragedy. One of them is Debbie Dills. She's trending on social media this morning. She's the woman, she was driving to work, she's a florist in North Carolina, and she sees a car, and she thinks it's the car that Dylan Roof has described as driving the suspect in the shooting. So she calls her boss, and she says, oh, I think this is him. She follows the car for 56 kilometers with police on the phone. Sure enough, it was Dylan Roof, and that's how they apprehended him. So she's trending on social media today, people calling her a hero, saying that she was the one who stopped him from potentially doing this again and from helping police to find him. And we also have trending Jon Stewart. He's the host of The Daily Show here in the U.S., and he's trending this morning, and there's a viral video of him from his show last night. He went on the air, and his show is a satire. He makes fun of politicians. He has a lot of jokes. But he said last night, he said, quote, I have one job, and it's a pretty simple job. I come in the morning, we look at the news, and I write jokes about it. But I didn't do my job today, so I apologize. And he goes on for about 5 minutes with a very serious discussion on race, on calling this a terrorist act, talking about some of the gun control laws, things that are behind this attack, and saying just what a tragedy it is, and that this happens again and again in the U.S., but there's no action on it. It's very similar to another viral video from his show right after the September 11th attacks. He came back on the air and had a monologue where he got very emotional and very passionate. So very similar to that. That video is going all over the internet today, and he's a trending topic this morning.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute. Japanese technology company SoftBank recently introduced what it calls a robot with a heart. Pepper the Robot introduced himself to the audience at SoftBank's recent introductory press conference. Last June, I received a heart and debuted as the world's first personal robot with emotion-detecting capabilities, and I have in me emotions I can feel. Pepper and his fellow robots with a heart have been designed to recognize human emotions and react to them with seeming anger, joy, or even irritation. Throughout the presentation, Pepper talked with guests, danced, sang a song, and showed how it can serve its human master. If you want to buy Pepper, be prepared to spend some good money for him. The cost is $1,600. The robots will be available only in Japan this year, with international sales set to begin in 2016. I'm Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an iconic Bob Dylan song turns 50. Australia's Institute for Economics and Peace this week issued its annual Global Peace Index, warning that the cost of violence worldwide has topped $14 trillion in 2014. It's equivalent to the combined gross domestic product of Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, and the United Kingdom. It noted that terrorism spread from the Middle East to Africa, while nearly 1% of the world's population are refugees or internally displaced. The IEP's founder and executive chairman, Steve Killilea, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty, and he says the $14 trillion number may actually be on the conservative side.
I think the thing which I always take away from this figure's probably conservative, because we can only count what we can count. We know there's a number of other items associated with either dealing with the consequences of violence or protecting against violence which we don't count. They'd be things like insurance premiums, CCTV cameras, electronic surveillance, mechanisms, and the many forms of petty crime and violence.
You talked about Syria being the most violent, while Iceland was the least violent. How did you determine that?
Well, what we do is we've got 23 different metrics which we use. They're broken down, if you like, into three different domains. One is societal safety and security, so that looks at crime, number of people in jail, state-sponsored terror on its citizens, number of the police force, etc. Militarization, so it looks at sophistication, militarization, percentage of GDP, number of armed personnel. And the third and final domain is ongoing conflict, which obviously countries like Syria, Iraq, and southern Sudan are steeped in.
Steve, the cost of supporting refugees and internally displaced people increased over 260% since 2008 to $128 billion. The number of people topped 50 million. That's the highest since the Second World War.
Yes, look, and it's a very, very disturbing trend. It's fueled mainly by the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, but not only those conflicts. Central African Republic have got a lot of the refugees. If we went back to the Ukraine, for example, so it had the second biggest drop last year in the Global Peace Index. And so you had 6,000 deaths there in the conflict, which I think is more than what most people realise. But more importantly, there's 1 million people displaced in the Ukraine alone. But if we come back to Syria, and that's probably the major factor in building up these numbers, of the 22 million people who were in Syria last time there was a census done, the estimates are there's somewhere between 9 and 13 million of them now displaced, which is putting massive strains on the neighbouring countries. So Turkey alone, I think, has got about 2.5 million refugees from Syria there.
The Middle East and North Africa, not surprisingly, the world's most violent regions. You mentioned Iraq, Syria, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Central African Republic, all countries that have become more violent over the past year.
What we're seeing, and this is quite a contradiction, actually, because last year, even given these intensive conflicts, the world's peacefulness actually remained approximately the same. So if we go to the really peaceful countries in Western Europe and a couple over in Asia, they're actually becoming more peaceful. So it's a story of two different ends. The countries at the bottom of the index are becoming less peaceful, where the country's at the top end of the index. Actually, a number of the European countries are now at historically high levels of peace. So as far as we can take the homicide rates back, which are about 100 years, they're at their lowest. And the percentage of GDP spent on the military has dropped substantially from, let's say, in the 1960s. A lot of them down to 40% of the expenditure.
That's Steve Killily of Australia's Institute for Economics and Peace. He says Libya saw the most severe drop in peace in 2014, falling down to 149 of 162 countries in the index. Ukraine was second. The index also found that deaths from terrorism increased 9% last year to 18,000, with terrorist activity spilling over into countries like Nigeria, Cameroon, and Niger from the Middle East. He says the worst terrorist incident since 9/11 occurred last year in Nigeria, where some 2,000 people were massacred by Boko Haram. This is VOA.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Music fans, and especially for the so-called baby boomer generation following World War II, iconic songs are now hitting the half-century mark. David Byrd and Ray McDonald sit down in the studio to discuss one of those songs.
If you remember 1965, you'll remember that the United States had just started sending land troops to a place called Vietnam. Lyndon Baines Johnson was president, and in music, the British invasion, topped by the Beatles, the four lads from Liverpool, had happened just a year before. But that was also the year that a landmark song by Bob Dylan was put out. Ray McDonald joins me here in the studio to talk about Like a Rolling Stone. Ray, why was Like a Rolling Stone so revolutionary?
It broke all the rules. To begin with, the song was over 6 minutes long, and it went immediately to number two on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles chart. That in itself was unheard of. Most singles were 2 and 3 minutes long, and Columbia Records originally split it over two sides of a 45, but the fans insisted on hearing the song itself. Dylan was a folk musician. He was not considered an electric musician, but this song turned him into a rock star, and it put him toe-to-toe with acts like the Beatles. In fact, the Beatles kept him out of number one. Help was at the top the week that Like a Rolling Stone came onto the charts. The lyrics were freeform. They were poetic. They were taken from a long poem that Dylan had written while he was on tour the month before. And the whole thing just seemed perfect for its time.
Dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you.
How does this compare to some of other Dylan songs, like The Times They Are A-Changing?
Well, I mean, Dylan got his He made his bones, he made his fame as a protest musician, as a folk musician who initially adapted the folk songs of Woody Guthrie and other folk musicians. He came out of the Greenwich Village folk scene, and as such, he was a bit of a niche performer. Like a Rolling Stone really thrust him into the rock mainstream, and it influenced an entire generation of rock artists. Paul McCartney remembers listening to the song with John Lennon and saying, well, it just seemed to go on forever and it opened new possibilities for us. Bruce Springsteen talks about how that opening snare drum was like kicking a door open in his mind. So he really set the template for artistic creativity within a hard rock setting.
Now, this song came out right before Bob Dylan kind of upset his fan base, all those folk listeners, by going electric. What exactly did this have to do with that?
Like a Rolling Stone hit the shelves on July 20th, 1965, and that was just a few days before Dylan and his band made their famous electric appearance at the Newport, Rhode Island Folk Festival. And that was really Dylan's coming out party for his rock phase. And it upset a lot of his more traditional fans, but it gained him an incredible new audience.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. You can hit him up at VOA_music on Twitter. You can also go on to our webpage, that's voanews.com. You can hear Ray count down the top 20 songs of the week and the top 5 songs of the week.
That's Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, and we're going to be rolling on out of here. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is all well and good to have legal guarantees of human rights, including freedoms of speech, assembly, and religion. But without the legal institutions to enforce such rights in the communities where most people live, these rights rarely become reality, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski. In many African countries, access to justice is hampered by too few courts and legal professionals, too long a distance between communities and institutions of justice, too little knowledge about the content of the law, and by corruption that breeds distrust of the justice system. Mali, for instance, has 300 lawyers for a population of 15 million. The majority of them live in Bamako, so despite laws providing for free legal aid, if you're a poor person upcountry, you don't have much of a chance to get it. That's why the United States is supporting the African Center for Justice and Mobile Courts. The interconnectedness of the world means that even people in remote and impoverished areas have a greater sense of their rights. A case in point is a widow and mother of 3 young girls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. After her husband's death, her in-laws threw her and her children out of their home. The mother found her way to a legal aid clinic that was able to point her toward Congolese laws supporting equal treatment of male and female children. And with the clinic's help, she and her daughters were able to return to their home. Access to justice doesn't just mean access to courts, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski. It means access to information and to government services from a government that is responsive to their needs. And the most responsive governments are those that are freely elected by citizens and that respect term limits in office. The United States wants to see systems of governance and justice that focus on citizens and that work for and empower the poorest people in society. This is the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do if you want to build stable, peaceful, prosperous, and just societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.